Paper 33, section 4. That's old single column, page 369. Nice little sweet sequence number there. All right. So, if you were here last time, you may remember that when we went through the previous two sections, the main theme there was the relationship between the Creator Son and the Creative Mother Spirit, specifically as they're working to put themselves in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity. And in that case, it's not the Trinity at some grand scale of some sort, you know, like maybe literally the grand scale of the grand universe. It's the local universe specific footprint, you know, downstepped expression of the Paradise Trinity as, you know, basically the overarching fact that everything is attempting to put itself in relation to, you know, the whole, so that all the parts can be associated in a real way, part of a greater whole. And so we spent a lot of time on that. However, now we're moving a little bit more into something that we'll see a lot as we get into the papers. You know, the early part of, or early portions of part two, the whole collection, vast collection of different types of beings in a local universe that allow it to function the way it needs to function. And there's one individual that stands as chief executive over all that diversity of beings that keep the local universe running as a system. And that's Gabriel. So so step one is to introduce him, even though we haven't gotten to officially to the primary eruption that we talk about at the beginning of the next paper, that if that, you know, official description of how it is that the Creator Son and Creative Mother Spirit go about initiating being creators in their local universe. But you know, you remember what you know, this is about the administration of the local universe here. So you know, since he's chief administrator, it's important to get him right up front here. All right, so let's get in a little bit and think about the nature of this very unique being in each local universe.
Okay, this is section 4, Gabriel, the chief executive. The bright and morning star is the personalization of the first concept of identity and ideal of personality conceived by the Creator Son and the local universe manifestation of the Infinite Spirit. Going back to the early days of the local universe, before the union of the Creator Son and the Mother Spirit in the bonds of creative association, back to the times before the beginning of the creation of their versatile family of sons and daughters, the first conjoint act of this early and free association of these two divine persons results in the creation of the highest spirit personality of the Son and the Spirit, the bright and morning star.
Okay, just a couple things. You know, that last statement, I think most of us know who've been around the revelation for a while. There's a simple example of you know, taking that expression from the Bible, bright and morning star, You know, and in a way, it really goes beyond the Bible. Most peoples had a very significant mythological relationship to Venus in the sky, and because Venus is closer to the sun than the Earth, Venus has two different modes in which it expresses itself. And initially, the ancients didn't put the two together. You'd have Venus appearing just after sunset, you know, because you know, think you're looking towards the sun, and Venus, since it's inside of us, it's going to not be too far away from the sun. So the sun sets, and then you know, and then there you see Venus, you know, above the horizon a ways and setting, you know, a while afterwards. So as a brilliant evening star. It may be that before the sun comes up, there's Venus hanging on the horizon, very bright and you know, catching your attention. And then shortly thereafter, you know, here comes the sun. You know, that's the bright and morning star. So brilliant evening star, bright morning star. You know, just are two expressions for Venus in those two different circumstances. And, you know, they obviously when everything in the sky was thought to be a god, you know, you would have, you know, you'd have two different gods for Venus in those two different modes. You know, they became words that were, you know, more than just a description. You know, they became words that you might capitalize, you know, bright and morning and star, and use it as a proper name even. And so it's in that spirit. The revelators, you know, were told that they couldn't coin expressions or proper names or words if they could find something that humans have that, you know, would adequately serve the purpose as an English name or designation for a particular being. You know, it's the same thing with Gabriel. I mean, you know, the actual firstborn of Nebadon, you know, isn't called Gabriel in the local universe tongue. He's not called a bright morning star in the super universe tongue or, you know, or anything like this. I mean, they're all just, you know, designations that we have that they've adopted. So, you know, it's pretty obvious just by the name, the fact that he's the very first, this, you know, heralding the dawn, see, of the bright morning star. So it works like that. And then it also works, if you look up the context in the Bible, you'll see it. It also, the way that expression is used feeds in. They do that all the time. They, you know, if it isn't just the name, but the way humans have used it is appropriate. And so that's why they commandeered that expression for that type of being, the firstborn creature in each local universe. All right. It's pretty obvious why, you know, since we have direct relationship to this being come visiting Mary and all that, you know, so Gabriel. Okay, the other thing there is just always be looking for greater understanding. If you're reading and it seems like they're specifying something and it's not immediately obvious, you know, especially if they're saying such and so and such and so, you know, obviously they're bringing in some distinction. Can you figure it out? Notice at the beginning there, they say, so the bright morning star is the personalization of the first concept of identity and ideal of personality. So they have this contrast. They have this greater description of two different modes of talking about it, a concept of identity and an ideal of personality. What, you know, why? What are they talking about there? Okay, an identity, remember, is you have a self, and when personality engages a self, and you know, it identifies with a self, that self is an identity. Then, okay, so concept of identity would be referring to a particular flavor of self that they've conceived of, literally. know, this is the conception and birth of Gabriel here. And then ideal of personality. Well, ideal is a spirit word. Personality, spirit pattern. So, you know, and identity and is related to personality. So you can see they're really referring to personality in both of them. But on the one hand, it's the mindal self. See, really. And then the former, and then the latter is more directly the spiritual nature of that individual. So the mindal nature, the spiritual nature, you know, engaged by personality. So, you know, seek to understand that kind of specificity when they throw it out. So we've got this highest spirit personality. But there's just one of them. I think I may have mentioned recently, in terms of spirit personalities in the local universe, where there's any number of them, you know, a significant number of them, the archangels are the highest spirit personalities. You know, they're made in large numbers. But Gabriel is even higher. He's the highest. He's going to be issues, you know, seemingly, of his ability to relate to lowly beings, perhaps, if he's very, very high, you know, spirit personality.
Would you say he's closest to divinity-like, then?
Yeah, we'll see that in just a second here. Yeah, we'll talk about that. Yeah.
Can I say something?
Yep.
Gabriel, the Archangel Gabriel, is really huge in the New Age movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's pretty amazing that we got that right, you know, that he's not the archangel, but he's the chief.
Yeah.
Just like the Archangel Michael, you know. So.
But, you know, again, you know, you talk about the revelators here for the fifth epical revelation, picking names to call, you know, to give to these various beings. Well, at some point, the bright morning star wanted to engage humans, and he needed to pick a name for himself. You know, hello, my name is Gabriel. So, you know, he picks that Hebrew name to call himself by. So again, he did the same thing long ago, and you know, now we can just, you know, so they didn't have to coin one. He already basically coined, you know, a human name. That he was going to go by, unlike Michael, you know, which is a little bit more the fifth epical revelation, getting specifics with that. Mm-hmm. But Gabriel has this sort of precedency. You've got this blend of things that entered the stream long ago that are connected to reality, things that are now being, you know, we'll talk about Emmanuel in a little bit. You know, there's one that's for the fifth epical revelation. It's like, no, you're not going to use that name for what you've been using it for. You're going to use it for this now. You know, but Gabriel, yeah, we're going to keep using the name that, you know, been used for that being for a long time.
You must have been using Michael for a long time, too, because they call it Archangel Michael.
Right, you have an Archangel Michael, but, you know, the idea that, you don't have an instance where the Creator Son declared himself, you know, it's like when you want to give me a proper name, call me Michael, but you definitely have the bright morning star saying this, you know.
Right.
I'm going to go by Gabriel. So let's get some more here.
Only one such being of wisdom and majesty is brought forth in each local universe. The Universal Father and the Eternal Son can, in fact do, create an unlimited number of sons in divinity equal to themselves. But such sons, in union with the daughters of the Infinite Spirit, can create only one bright and morning star in each universe. A being like themselves and partaking freely of their combined natures, but not of their creative prerogatives. Gabriel of Salvington is like the universe sun in divinity of nature, though considerably limited in the attributes of deity.
Okay, so that's it, Nick, that last thing. So, I mean, very literally, he's definitely a divine being. Okay, but he's not literally his self, that concept of identity we were talking about up there, is not literally deity substance. So it's not personalized deity. He's not God. So, you know, when you think of divinity as being deity likeness, when they're saying, you know, considerably limited in the attributes of deity, yes, I mean, the kind of divinity isn't literally, you know, deity likeness directly. However, you can see that they're pointing out not only is he the highest spirit personality, but he must be about as close to being personalized deity as you can get without being in some way. Because they're speaking in the terms of you have a universal Father, the eternal Son, making creator sons who are a personalized deity, and they can do it multiple times. And here they're saying that there's some parallel, very close parallel, where the creator Son and the creator Mother Spirit can only do this sort of act one time. So it must be pretty close to being personalized deity. And you know, you have another example, there's another comment that's made that points to just how close. He's not a creator being, Gabriel, but he can procreate. You know, it's not a general, do you have these beings being able to procreate? But, you know, they tell you that Gabriel and the Father Melchizedek as a pair, as a differential pair, can generate, we can procreate offspring, sporanga. So, see, he's not a creator, but a procreator. So close, very close. Let's see, what else? And then just that fact that I've mentioned a few times, remind yourself again, I just mentioned him, Gabriel and Father Melchizedek. So you have these two sons, and one is very much like the Creator Son, and then one is dominantly like the Creative Mother Spirit as a son. Just like you have Adam's son and Eve's son, you have Adam Ben Adam, you know, Adam, son of Adam, and Adam, Ben Eve, Adam, son of Eve, that's Eve's son. You have these two sons, one taking, you know, dominance from each of the parents. So, you know, Gabriel is the one that's, that's very close to being everything that a creator son is to a local universe except the creator fact. So just you can just think of it as a downstepped expression of a creator son in many ways. However, they're going to make a comment here in a second. A little bit more to it than that.
The firstborn of the parents of a new universe is a unique personality possessing many wonderful traits not visibly present in either ancestor. A being of unprecedented versatility and unimagined brilliance. This supernal personality embraces the divine will of the Son combined with the creative imagination of the Spirit. The thoughts and acts of the bright and morning star will ever be fully representative of both the Creator Son and the Creative Spirit. Such a being is also capable of a broad understanding of and sympathetic contact with both the spiritual seraphic hosts and the material evolutionary will creatures.
Okay, so first of all, they remind you that even though he's going to be, in many ways, you know, this slightly downstepped expression of a creator son, he's a super additive consequence of the two. So there's some things that are upstepped about his nature relative to the Creator Son and the Creative Mother Spirit. There's some things that he is that's above them, as well as being below them. See, it depends on how you look at it. Every offspring is a super additive consequence and transcends their parents in some way. All right, so... and that's part of what we're up to here in the universe of universes.
William would like to know, please explain the technical difference between creation and procreation.
Okay. I mean, humans procreate, so we all kind of have an idea of what procreation is about. You know, we aren't creator beings, but we can be the point of initiating bringing a new being into existence. It's just that is a creative phenomenon that's flowing through us, not originating in us. Okay? That's why we call it procreation. And long ago, we recognized we weren't creator beings, but we were doing something similar. You know, so you're a conduit for the creative act. The creative act is coming, manifesting through you as a procreator. But it's not originating within you. When you're a creator being, it originates within you. You are the source, not just the means. Okay, so a creator son and a creator mother spirit are creator beings. They're the source of that that being coming into existence. It's not just flowing. It's not flowing through them from above. They're part of the creative act. I mean, if you want to think about it in terms of the first source and center of all things and beings, some ability to create. The universal creator, the first source and center, universal father, divested himself of part of that ability to create. He can't create Gabriel. And he isn't creating Gabriel through the creator, son, and the creator, mother, spirit. He's handed that off. He has no ability to do that as, he's not the source. They're the source. So some of that source, first source, has been delegated. Creatorship has been distributive. There's that self-distributive deity of the universal creator. Okay? So that's the difference, William, we're part of bringing children of the Father into existence as procreators. We're not creators. Okay, let's see. What else was there? So the super additive part. So there's some from each side and more. So he's very, a supernal personality. All these things they're talking about how, unprecedented versatility, unimagined brilliance, and he's got all of this flexibility, and not only that, but then notice what they say at the end. Such a being is also capable of a broad understanding of and sympathetic contact with both the spiritual seraphic hosts, so obviously he has that ability he gets from his mother, who's the creator of those seraphic hosts, cherubim and seraphim, etc., and material evolutionary will creatures. Well, the creator son by himself brings material sons and daughters into existence. So, you can see directly him getting that attribute from his father. And you go, oh, wow, and that, even though he's the highest spirit personality from Michael, he's gotten an ability, a nature that reaches all the way down, so that it's not that complicated for him personally to visit Mary and Elizabeth and do other such things down at the material level, where it's not so straightforward for an archangel to do that. So an archangel's not as high, but they don't have that vertical reach within their being. And the archangels are so definitively high spiritually, they can't directly interact with a secondary midwayer, and they had to use the contact personality to get a paper that was authored by an archangel to us. Whereas Melchizedek, say, can just directly talk to the secondary midwayer. You don't need the contact personality. You can just dictate it to him. Yeah, those handful of individuals that are, you know, too high to directly engage, they needed to use that called complicated means. Yeah, and if Gabriel had written a paper, right, he could have just, you know, it would have been much more straightforward for him. Okay. All right, yep, so let's get some more now.
The bright morning star is not a creator, but he is a marvelous administrator, being the personal administrative representative of the Creator's Son. Aside from creation and life impartation, the Son and the Spirit never confer upon important universe procedures without Gabriel's presence.
So just, you know, little paragraph, there's two little things in there. One, just stating directly, like I said, he's the personal administrative representative of the Creator's Son. You know, not the both of them, but see, he's very specific to the Creator's Son. And then the fact that he's very much like them, except for being a creator, and has some super additive things, they need his input. Okay. So, you know, in many ways, there's a threefold, administration at the top. Some things that give them the full picture only come from Gabriel. And that, you know, that sort of stuff is just fascinating. So you have a creature, you know, helping God. Because God and more God, you know, God Father and God Mother, you know, this dual God head of the local universe doesn't have the full perspective themselves. You know, this sort of use of the word God, see, is a challenge from a historical perspective. Because fundamentally God is personalized deity, and deity has all kinds of different specificities of manifestation. Even the Father is definitively circumscribed, just like we were talking about. There's a whole bunch of things that he can't even remotely do. You know, he's not the deity that functions in that sphere. So it doesn't matter if it's personalized deity. His deity does not do those things. Some other facets of deity do those things. Yeah, so you have this distributive expression of God's action. All right. Let's get some more here.
Gabriel of Salvington is the chief executive of the universe of Nevadon and the arbiter of all executive appeals respecting its administration. This universe executive was created fully endowed for his work, but he has gained experience with the growth and evolution of our local creation.
Okay, so, you know, we've seen some high administrators going through a training process, you know, before they went on the job. But not so with Gabriel. He pretty much hits the ground running. But he's an experiential being, as they're pointing out here. So he grows in relationship to experiential deity, just like we are. And, increases in wisdom. No matter how divine his wisdom is to begin with, it can always be expanded upon. If nothing else, he's just of one of the local universes to begin with. There's a whole rest of the universe of universes that he isn't innately in relationship to. So there's a lot that he can acquire in experiential wisdom. Okay. let's see. I guess that's... Just to stress, you know, he's the chief executive, the arbiter of all executive appeals respecting its administration. And so here is where they're starting to really challenge your initial thoughts about Michael of Nevadon. Nothing goes up to him, basically. See, Gabriel's the arbiter of all, not most, all executive appeals. So he's very, yeah, right, he's very definitively the chief executive. And he needs to be in that mode because Michael has to leave a lot, like we talked about. You know, and sometime in the future, in the local universe of settled in life, light and life, the revelators say, there may become a time when Michael just completely leaves and never comes back to the local universe. So very much so, Gabriel has to be in the all mode on this. You know, he has to be able to take care of everything. And, you know, when we get to the next section, we'll see, it's like, well, but he's got some limitations. How does he do that? Well, we'll see in the next section. He gets there's a little bit of help when he has to take care of everything and can't confer with Michael on something.
Gabriel is the chief officer of execution for super universe mandates relating to non-personal affairs in the local universe. Most matters pertaining to mass judgment and dispensational resurrections adjudicated by the Ancients of Days are also delegated to Gabriel and his staff for execution. Gabriel is thus the combined chief executive of both the super and the local universe rulers. He has at his command an able corps of administrative assistants created for their special work who are unrevealed to evolutionary mortals. In addition to these assistants, Gabriel may employ any and all of the orders of celestial beings functioning in Nebadon. And he is also the commander-in-chief of the armies of heaven, the celestial hosts.
Okay. And I've mentioned this a number of times, you know, over recent months as well. Here you see it again. Remember how close a linkage there is between Gabriel and the Ancients of Days. A linkage that becomes fully manifest when a local universe is settled in light and life. The bright and morning star at that point really becomes the deputy of the Ancients of Days. Father Melchizedek is associated with the supreme executive and his hierarchical structure. Gabriel becomes associated with the Ancients of Days and their hierarchical structure. You know, and so they become the agents, the local agents for that Trinity administration. When really the local universe becomes effectively part of the super universe and not a lower, you know, potential like we are now. You know, we're the actuality of our relationship to the super universe is very limited right now. We don't have representation even, you know, on the super universe level as a local universe. So, but all of that, you know, the local universe slowly is growing up until finally it's up at the level of the super universe, and then you really see this. And so the only thing really is the specifics of personality extinction. You know, if there's someone who's chosen iniquity and, you know, the divine executioner is going to eliminate that body, per the instructions of the Ancients of Days, that doesn't get handed off to Gabriel. But all of the technical details of resurrections and everything, you know, the Ancients of Days already, even now, hand that off to Gabriel. So, again, just foreshadowing that future relationship that he really is working for the Ancients a lot right now. And that's something, see, that's kind of super Creator Son, Creator Mother Spirit. That's God at a higher level acting through Gabriel. So the fact that he's a super additive consequence of the relationship between the two kind of, see, allows him to be functioning above their heads in this way a bit, naturally. So again, that's all, you know, it's all very kind of odd to begin to get used to, having this kind of delegation of God acting and then creatures coming in. But remember, it works even for us. When we get up to Uversa, the Ancients of Days are going to be delegating stuff to us. We'll be at that level of integrity that God will say, well, I don't need to do this anymore. Nick, you can do this now. And you're, you know. you know.
Okay,
all right, so You know, that's the way the universe works. It's not all about God. You know, increasingly divine creatures are meant to be equals in many ways to God acting in the universe of universes. That also, see, is very different from any sort of a, you know, ancient notion of God and God's relationship to humans or other creatures. All right, let's see, anything else in there? Oh, yeah, just, you know, you got to wonder, so who are unrevealed to evolutionary mortals? Why? I mean, I don't know. I keep hoping one day I'm going to stumble on something that's going to be a clue to that. I don't have the slightest idea of why these administrative assistants would be unrevealed. I don't know. I'm waiting for a light bulb to go off at some point on that one. I mean, the only thing you can think of is that they must somehow have a lot of, you know, to say anything about them would be to disclose something about the other six schemes, maybe, or something, besides the ascension scheme. I don't know.
Remember when they talk about other beings that they can't tell you about that are also very close to you.
Yeah, right.
That they sort of mention, but they don't reveal them. You know, you can often wonder if there's something else going on that is not revealed to us at all in the process of evolution in out here in the with that these guys might be working with, you know, these beings they don't reveal to us, because that's a secret. They said, would we be betraying our trust if we told you?
It would be akin to a betrayal of trust. Yes.
Right. So that's another one of those. Yeah. Like, who could that be?
Yeah. Well, those are the lesser order of angels. We've talked about those a number of times. Okay. Yeah.
Yep. Well, to me, too, I don't always look at it as they can't reveal it to us. It's just that there's limited real estate on the pages.
Well,
can't go into detail about everybody.
Right. We've talked about it. I mean, you know, it could be something just like that. I mean, that in order to reveal them and still have a holistic revelation, you'd have to reveal a whole bunch of other beings, and it just would get beyond the scope.
That's not what it says. Says it's not revealed to mortals. I mean, doesn't say to us.
I know, right? But just in general, the unrevealed things. You know, there can be things like that where, we talked about that in paper 30. You know, they needed to pick a subset of all beings that was, internally consistent. You know, and if you added one more, you'd have to add, 600,000 more. You know, something like that. And it's like, no, that would get too big. So let's limit it to this. You know, they need a set that it's logically consistent, where we're not going to come up, it's like, well, wait a minute, it's missing a being. It's obviously missing a being. You know, it's not like that. It's a complete set. It's a subset in some way. Mm-hmm.
And I think if they use the word undisclosed, that would perk me up more than saying unrevealed.
Yeah, so again, it's just all these different things. It just leaves you very curious, you know, is it unrevealed or undisclosed because it touches upon matters close to us, and that way, and you can't do that. You know, is it just because it's out of the scope of the revelation? It doesn't have meaning to do with the ascension scheme, et cetera. You have all these different things. So it's just a big mystery. Why? It sounds like they're a pretty significant, element of the local universe that we're missing here to not know about them. So you wonder how many other really big things about the local universe, other suns that aren't revealed, for instance, and those sorts of things that could be a huge part of what goes on in a local universe, and there's no hint of it in here.
So why do you think they keep the term armies of heaven alive? It sort of connotes military or, things that, for me, it's kind of like an oxymoron. So it's a long term for celestial hosts.
It's an oxymoron from a historical perspective on angels. The only thing that hints of it in our mythology is we assign that kind of sword sort of stuff to archangels, quote unquote. Archangel Michael, quote, he's always there with the sword. They bring that in not only because it's a very straightforward analogy to use the hierarchical structure of an army to describe the hierarchical structure of angels, of seraphim, but also to just be a constant reminder that They may be ministers of mercy in general, but that's not all that the angels do. I mean, the angels also get assigned more father-like than mother-like modes. They get assigned more, these injections. These are the angels of the trumpets, it says, of the angels of nation life. Okay, I mean, yes, those are master seraphim, but even the non-ascended seraphim have been ordered by the creative mother spirit, to foster, the potential for sin expression, which is not as,
They act in that way sometimes. I mean, remember when Jesus mentioned, right now I could get called 12 reasons, whatever, right. But he didn't necessarily. But do you think there's actually times?
Yes, there's times when they're marshaled, and yes, and yeah, that's trying to get it. So, I mean, they don't talk about that a lot, but, it's there occasionally between the lines that they are at times the army and are doing things very, like we think of an army, very overt, very aggressive. It just adds to this chief executive that he's also commander in chief like this, So it's, we have that concept embodied in our presidency. They point out that there are elements of how things are set up in the United States that aren't coincidental. They've been working for millennia to slowly bring that which is above down below. And more and more, a world's government begins to reflect the three, bodies on high, executive, legislative, judicial, etc., these sorts of things. Having a chief executive. You shouldn't be surprised. I mean, now if you're skeptical, of course, about this thing, you're going, whoever wrote this is just, it's all anthropomorphic. They're taking human forms and, casting them up into heaven. It's like, no, it works the other way around. Everything is coming top down. Every form we have here has some sort of source on high. Everything.
Like John was saying, applied love as a flip side, applied justice.
Yeah, just make one more comment. That's a great thing to bring in. I should have mentioned that. I mean, just again, thinking of the source of all love, the first source and center. And we've stressed that a number of times here recently. There is no difference between the word love and the word law in the first source and center. They're the same fact. So, that's just a little reminder. You may get downstepped way down to seraphim, but love has a flip side of law. So sometimes the angels are instruments of law, of justice, as well as instruments of mercy, love. Okay.
Just a quick question. The way that it comes down from above, how does it come down? Is it through auto-revelation to these creators of our government that they are inspired to have the three?
No, the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men. There's all kinds of manipulation of mankind behind the scenes and stuff, and not so behind the scenes. Remember, one of the easiest ways they have for tweaking things is the cosmic reservists. You've got, right now there's over 1,000 of them. You have these humans, they're literal mortals, live and die, but they are brought into the planetary government. They could be in some high-level meeting, there's someone's aide or something, and in the middle of a really difficult meeting, where they're brainstorming, trying to figure out what to do, the aide might say, what about this idea? We could try this. And they go, wow, that's a great idea. We should do that. Unbeknownst to anyone in the room, the Most High told that cosmic reservist, see if you can get him to go down this path, suggest such and so. They do this. There's some micromanagement of significant elements. But then there's all kinds of other things, too, that are more behind the scenes. The secondary midwares, manipulate things behind the scenes, limiting a group's ability to express themselves if the planetary government, especially in our case, the Most High Observer, if he says, no, you need to subject their thoughts. And so those people try and they just can't seem to get any traction because the midwayers are putting monkey wrenches in the works behind the scenes. There's all kinds of stuff like this is going on. Not to mention the angels and primary midwayers and, those lesser angels that they, there's lots and lots of them, unlike secondary midwayers. They're tweaking things all the time. You know, it'd be akin to a betrayal of trust to even tell us how much they're getting in, to our affairs.
And all your ideas may not come from you.
There's all kinds of things that are going on. I mean, right. And it all works together in a vast conspiracy called the whole. Right? Right. The things that a particular adjuster manages to somehow find a way to get into your consciousness, coincidentally, matches right up with what a Verondadex son is thinking ought to be done. And there was no communication there. All this. It's a vast conspiracy.
So this is all a grand experiment. But compared to a normal planet, there is so much more going on behind the scenes.
Right. And there's been a lot of very odd things that have gone on, in the foreground on this planet too. And there probably will be even odder things that will go on in the foreground, like we've talked about. I mean, it's going to be very odd to have a Melchizedek be a planetary prince one day. And who knows what other suns that are unrevealed might come into play. I mean, there's some potentials for some curious things, right? There's this. But the very fact that we have an archangel, divisional headquarters here, that means there could be all kinds of things that are out of the normal ascension scheme that are going to be brought manifest on this world. So, you just don't want to, put any limits on what might happen that's relatively unique here.
Chris?
Yep.
I thought we had two types of cosmic reservists. Well, we have cosmic reservists.
And destiny reservists.
And we have the destiny. So the destiny, there's 972 as of the writing of the book. And then there are, of the cosmic, who actually know that they're reservists. The other ones only act like in 15-minute increments.
Right, or whatever.
But the cosmic reservists now number over 1,000 mortals.
Right.
So we essentially have 2,000.
Yeah, we got roughly 2,000 individuals, and half of them are fully aware and are acting all the time. They have Monday morning meetings with the resident governor general. Okay, the destiny reservists are by and large clueless. And most of them will do nothing during their life. They'll live and die, never being activated to do anything. But not the cosmic reservists.
They all have the self-acting adjusters. So okay. I was thinking the ones that are in the meeting are probably more likely to hear that little voice and then go ahead suggestion.
You can endlessly speculate. Say, we're speculating.
But I mean,
we don't really know what to make of these cosmic reservists because they don't tell us much of anything other than the fact that they exist.
And they meet on Monday morning.
And I'm assuming that they meet on Monday morning like everyone does. Yeah. All right.
So you haven't been to one of those meetings?
No, I have not been. Yeah.
Gabriel and his staff are not teachers. They are administrators. They were never known to depart from their regular work except when Michael was incarnated on a creature bestowal. During such bestowals, Gabriel was ever attendant on the will of the incarnated son, and with the collaboration of the Union of Days, he became the actual director of the universe affairs during the later bestowals. Gabriel has been closely identified with the history and development of Urantia ever since the mortal bestowal of Michael.
Okay. Just that whole bit about they were never known. Becomes the exception to the rule when you get to the seventh bestowal. And both Gabriel and the Father Melchizedek can let go of their normal duties because in that case, Emmanuel took over. So you didn't need either of them on Salvington. You know, as we know, they were both here simultaneously. You know, that's the only time when Emmanuel was in charge in both of them. But even when, you know, in the other bestowals, and if Gabriel has to be really involved, like he has to be involved very intimately in bestowals 4, 5, 6, and 7, he's an attendant, you know, in those bestowals. As we talked about when we did paper 119. So, you know, Father Melchizedek is going to be handling things on Salvington, and Gabriel and his crew are going to be doing very out-of-the-norm things during those times. Yeah, but like I said, nothing was more out of the norm than for that brief number of years during the seventh bestowal when it's totally in the hands of Emmanuel. All right.
The last
sentence. Oh, yeah. Oh.
We've been closely identified with the history and development, which I imagine is moving forward of this planet ever since Michael's bestowal. Meaning
most directly that, you know, this is Michael's world. Michael obviously has plans that Gabriel is overseeing as the chief executive. Things like that no one else understands what's going on, like the Archangel Divisional Headquarters, all these sorts of, you know, what's going on the local system level. You know, on Gerasim, there's things that are unique too. So Michael has all these plans that Gabriel is overseeing that, and Gabriel's not really telling anyone what's going on, but he's, yeah. So, you know, you wonder how often Gabriel visits, for instance. See. You know, those things, those sorts of things. You know, talk about being closely identified. You know, there's a low stone table that kind of got it all started. Some pretty close identification. You know, hello, Mary. My neighbor, my name is Gabriel. Not to mention Elizabeth. So, okay. Yeah, and just, yeah, it's a loaded statement. See, obviously there's a whole bunch of things going on. I would think that, you know, Gabriel and Machaventa must have lots of conversations about this whole sequence of events. You know, that, for instance, the chief of Seraphim, the Supernaphim, is really frustrated by. It's like, why hasn't Machaventa assumed planetary prince already? You know, he can't figure out why it didn't happen immediately, you know, as soon as he was vicegerent planetary prince. You know, there's something going on with Machaventa and Gabriel. They've probably got a big plan going, some scheme about when this is all going to happen and what's going to go on.
Agreed.
All right. Yeah.
All right. Aside from meeting Gabriel on the bestowal worlds, and at the times of general and special resurrection roll calls, mortals will seldom encounter him as they ascend through the local universe until they are inducted into the administrative work of the local creation. As administrators of whatever order or degree, you will come under the direction of Gabriel.
It's kind of fun. You can see, you know, you'll be roaming around and you'll get to witness various resurrections on other worlds and stuff, and you know, and you might bump into Gabriel associated with those things somewhere, you know, in some world besides your own, somewhere in your ascension. But when you get up to Salvington, you know, like a, you know, he starts delegating things to you. It's like, okay, I, Gabriel, don't have to do this anymore. Nick, I got a job for you. I mean, I don't know why he keeps picking on Nick, but. I guess so. To him who much is given is much expected. But yeah, that's, you know, we've talked about that. This you know, we get very intimate, you know, in the administrative process. You know, it really starts to get significant when we get up to, in our case, Adentia, when we get up to the Constellation Headquarters, and the Most Highs say, you know, you're worthy of some delegation now, and they start. You know, we start working intimately with them, and that just, you know, continues all the way up. All right. So now, you know, off to the side, we've got this little reminder that even though this is a dual phenomenon in the local universe, it's destined to be part of the Trinity. government of the super universe. And so right from the beginning, you've got this Trinity ambassador of the Ancients of Days, who's there with the Creator Son and the Creator Mother Spirit. You know, in a way, being that linkage and that overarching guidance that assures that it will eventually merge into the super universe. It's not going to be a coincidence, you know, that this very unique administration of our creative parents ends up fitting into the super universe. You know, the super universe administration is down there side by side, being part of that guiding process so that, sure enough, it matches in perfectly, you know, one day in the future. Okay, so let's read about that.
The Trinity Ambassadors, 5. The administration of Trinity origin personalities ends with the government of the super universes. The local universes are characterized by dual supervision, the beginning of the father-mother concept. The universe father is the creator son. The universe mother is the divine minister, the local universe creative spirit. Every local universe is, however, blessed with the presence of certain personalities from the central universe and paradise. At the head of this paradise group in Nebadon is the ambassador of the Paradise Trinity, Emmanuel of Salvington, the union of days assigned to the local universe of Nebadon. In a certain sense, this high Trinity Son is also the personal representative of the Universal Father to the court of the Creator Son, hence his name, Emmanuel.
So that last part, they're going to explain why they, you know, took that name. Like, no, you're not going to use that as a synonym for Michael anymore, like you've been wanting to do in the New Testament. We're going to confiscate that name, and we're going to use it for another being, because the literalness of that, you know, Emmanuel, God with us, you know, El is God, you know, God with us, is, you know, more appropriately applied to the union of days than it is to the Creator Son. Remember at the beginning, you know, they mentioned the Christ Michael, and we talked about that. Michael, who's like God, you know, Christ, the Anointed One. You know, the Anointed One is like God. It's basically a question and an answer. You're the same thing. You know, if you're going to point to someone who's even more definitively, as they're saying here, the personal representative of the Universal Father, more so than Michael, Emmanuel, the union of days, is more so the personal representative of the Universal Father. Remember when we were talking about how in many, many ways it's very, very difficult, even for high beings, like this was Lucifer's problem, it's very difficult to really see the Universal Father in a Creator Son. You know, especially if that Creator Son is like ours, and he manifests more of the Eternal Son side than the Universal Father side, you know, of his parents. Okay. So now, but why, you say, why would a union of days be such a definitive personal representative of the Universal Father? They're Trinity origin, not directly tied to the Father at all. Okay, you have to look at who they're first and foremost a representative of, the Ancients of Days. And in the hierarchy of fathers, you know, as you start with a biologic father and you go all the way up, the top you have the Havona Father, you know, the Universal Father in Havona as a Father Absolute. Who's next down in the hierarchy of fathers? The superfathers, the Ancients of Days. So even though the Ancients of Days are Trinity origin, in terms of how, what kind of a an action of personalized deity you see very definitively coming through them in a number of ways, it's very father-like. They're the superfathers. They're the capital J judges. They're that capital L, capital A, capital W made God in many ways. They are the law, right?
What are the names of the ones on Havona?
Well,
for each sphere.
Well, those are the Eternals of days.
They're pretty. They're similar beings.
Right, but they're not in that father hierarchy. See, that father hierarchy, you know, it skips over them in a sense. You know, it goes from the Havona Father, from the Universal Father, down to the Ancients of Days. Because remember, the Eternals of Days aren't God. They're just really, really high creatures. They're not personalized deity. So that's another thing. You know, the Eternals of Days are like Unions of Days, who aren't God either, aren't personalized deity. It's just the Eternals of Days are the highest of that flavor. Okay, so they're the Unions of Days are these very definitive representatives of those super fathers. That first downstepped expression from the eternal universe of fatherness. You know? So that's why they are these definitive personal representatives. And I mentioned that, you know, that definitive linkage. You know, of all the times we know about, when did Emmanuel very definitively manifest himself as the personal representative of the Universal Father? During the seventh bestowal, when he took over and he reminded Michael, okay, now you normally run things in kind of an eternal son mode. Okay, that's not the way it's going to be when I'm in charge. I'm running it in a father mode. Okay, and if anyone even looks cross-eyed relative to rebellion, they're snuffed. Okay, just like that. It's going to be a very definitive fiat father sort of hand. See? So that's, you see it very definitively there. This would be, you can see how important Emmanuel's counsel would be to Michael. If Michael's, you know, or turn it around, when would Michael, you know, very much turn to Emmanuel for counsel? You know, if he'd like to. It's like, well, now, from a pure father perspective, how do you see this circumstance? And Emmanuel could tell him, you know, and then he could take that, you know, approach or not, especially now that he's sovereign. You know, he can do it however he wants. But it would be a voice of a more definitive father perspective on the circumstance than Michael can bring to bear.
Hence, paper
119
is a good example.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So, see, these are the kind of things. You know, so, here again, you've got someone who's not God being a very definitive aid to God, to a creator son. All right. And then on top of that, besides that, there's also that Trinity representation. You can set all the capital J judges and divine executioners and all that stuff aside, you know, there's the fact that you have Father deity, Son deity, Spirit deity, Mother deity, but you also have a voice local of the Paradise Trinity itself, too, that can be expressed through that unity. So you get even more broad perspective. And then you have those unqualified supervisors of the Supreme roaming around in a local universe that bring, you know, the perspective of the Supreme Being very definitively into play. So you have all these different, you know,
all the finalers,
yeah, right? Yeah, not to mention the finalers and who are independent of the local universe government, doing their thing, right? So all these different perspectives are playing together, but you know, and we'll see here in the next one, this particular one is very close to the Creator Son. Now, Union of Days has this very, you know, intimate right hand position in terms of being an advisor.
Emmanuel of Salvington, number 611, 121 of the Sixth Order of Supreme Trinity Personalities, is a being of sublime dignity, of such superb condescension that he refuses the worship and adoration of all living creatures. He bears the distinction of being the only personality in Nebadon who has never acknowledged subordination to his brother Michael. He functions as advisor to the Sovereign Son, but gives counsel only on request. In the absence of the Creator Son, he might preside over any high universe council, but would not otherwise participate in the executive affairs of the universe, except as requested.
So, like I said, that very exceptional time during the seventh bestowal is the exception to that rule. But here you see something very interesting. Though there are, you know, and they made sure, just like before, they want you to go back and read about the unions of days. Those are the sixth order of the Supreme Trinity personalities. As you go down through all the of days, they're number six. They want you to go back and refresh your memory about that. And you've got this, oh, so the union of days, there's 700,000 of them, you know, all in place, all in existence. And they're sequentially numbered and match up with the Creator Sons. Okay, so they have some sort of very intimate linkage here with the 700,000 Creator Sons that are going to be, you know, attached to local universes. So that's why there's this, you know, Michael, our Creator Son, refers to him as his brother. See, it's this, it's because of that number. It's not just any old being. Okay, there's a very tight linkage here. They're assigned, you know, one-to-one with the 700,000 local universe Creator Sons. It makes you wonder then about, you know, those Creator Sons beyond the 700,000, you know, is there some being that's unrevealed that are close to them? Or maybe there's none, and that's one of the things that beings on high speculate about. Is there going to be some being in the next age, you know, that matches up with them, that's kind of like a union of days matches up with these now, or, you know, those sorts of things. But that's the brother reference. It's that fact that that number is the same number, 611,121st. They're paired up. Okay. Let's see. And, you know, he refuses the worship and adoration of all living creatures very appropriately because he's not God. Okay. That would be a good thing to not take on when you're not God. And then then you notice the word subordination. He bears the distinction as being the only personality in all Nebadon who has never acknowledged subordination to his brother Michael. Okay, why? Now, that's when we're talking about the subordination in the previous sections, you know, between the Creator Son and the Creator Mother Spirit, that they're both working to get themselves into cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity, circumscribed to this local universe. See, Emmanuel has never put himself, you know, in subordination because he's, you know, he's a Trinity origin being. He's in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity on a bigger scale. He's not going to put himself down underneath that downstepped ceiling of the Paradise Trinity, you know, that's just local universe specific. He's in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity at a bigger scale. And like I was saying, that's obviously the immediacy of that is super universe scale. That's the whole point. He brings that bigger picture, that bigger totality attitude, side by side, you know, in an advisory mode, down into this more circumscribed domain. That even when you have a master son, is still circumscribed. It's only that much of the Paradise Trinity through the Supreme. And that's another thing, too, that's going on. You have the Paradise Trinity here in the context of the Supreme. It's not pure, you might say, direct. But as a Trinity origin being, a union of days has this very direct relationship with the Paradise Trinity, not via the Mother or via the Supreme, but direct. So again, there's that element. Okay. Let's see. And again, that whole bit that he only gives counsel on request.
Well, there are other
Trinity origin sons in the local universe that are lesser than Emmanuel.
Yeah, we're about to get to them here in the...
Oh. Okay, sorry.
Well, Emmanuel's the sixth order, so how many orders are there total?
One more. We're about to read about the... Seven. Yeah, the next one down. Yeah, just go... I was just saying, go back and, you know, you have the Trinity secrets of supremacy, the eternals of days, the ancients of days, et cetera. You just go down the stack. You know, and they're part of the stationary sons of the Trinity. You have 10 in that list because you bring in the divine counselors, the universal censors, and the perfectors of wisdom. But you have 7 in that, you know, that are, you know, that are those of days like ones, you know. Yeah. Let's see. Yes, let's go forward. Yeah.
This ambassador of paradise to Nebadon is not subject to the jurisdiction of the local universe government. Neither does he exercise authoritative jurisdiction in the executive affairs of an evolving local universe, except in the supervision of his liaison brethren, the faithfuls of days, serving on the headquarters of the constellations.
Yeah, so see, there they are, Gene. Yeah, so that final notch down, the faithfuls of days. You know, again, you know, you can go back and remind yourself when we went through that paper. You know, they're faithfuls because, like we pointed out that just a little bit ago, the Most Highs have this very tight linkage to the Ancients of Days, at the constellation level, and that's the ceiling of faithfulness. You know, rebellion. You know, can't get to this constellation scope. You know, it's contained in local system scope because there's faithfulness that encompasses local systems in a constellation. You know, they're referring to that by the, you know, using that name for those Trinity ambassadors that are at the constellation level. That's definitively the faithful level. You know, and again, so bringing Trinity government perspective down there close to the Most Highs, because the Most Highs are linked to the Ancients of Days, so they have to have that. In the case of the Union of Days, like we're pointing out, see, in many ways, even though working a lot with the Creator's Son and this intimacy of brother-like linkage, but who's the person that is really immediately tied in executive nature to the Ancients of Days? It's not Michael, it's Gabriel. You know? So if Gabriel and the Most Highs are downstep expressions of the Ancients of Days governing hand, and when the local universe is settled in light and life, they, you know, fully manifest that foreshadowing that they have now. And the Most Highs become the Most Highs. They really, you know, take over rulership. That's why they're called the Most Highs, even though they're, you know, definitely downstepped from a Creator Son and a Creator Mother Spirit. Eventually they become the bosses, and Michael goes off and does other things. They become the, you know, the chief executives.
The faithfuls of days, like the Union of Days, never proffer advice or offer assistance to the constellation rulers unless it is asked for. These paradise ambassadors to the constellations represent the final personal presence of the stationary sons of the Trinity, functioning in advisory roles in the local universes. Constellations are more closely related to the superuniverse administration than local systems, which are administered exclusively by personalities native to the local universe.
So it's kind of saying what I was just saying there. And because the local systems are exclusively administered by local universe personalities, that has consequences sometimes. They don't have innately as big a picture in play. You know, the Verondadex sons, you know, they're incapable of rebellion. You know, they're high enough, they're clear enough of the big picture that they can't fundamentally go astray. But they're not all wise. You know, there's some limitations in their wisdom. But they've got a faithful of days right there that has a very big picture. Again, you know, that picture of the super universe size, you know, big picture, you know, brought down side by side. So that really helps them to have an integrity that they don't totally have on their own, to have that close aid.
Well, my original question still stands.
Okay.
Because the union of days is the only personality, which implies that the faithfulness of days are subordinate in some way.
Oh, yeah, right. But you notice what they just said. I mean, yes, the faithfuls of days have put themselves down at the constellation level. So they're, you know, they've subordinated themselves down into the local universe like that. But, you know, what did it just say there? Where in the heck was that? Neither does he, the union of days, exercise authoritative jurisdiction in the executive affairs of an evolving local universe, except in the supervision of his liaison brethren, the faithfuls of days. See, so that he hands down that absence of subordination big picture to them in directing them. They themselves, you know, put themselves very definitively in the local universe. But he's, you know, he exercises authority over them. So, you know, if the big picture needs to come through them, it comes through from the union of days to them, you know, sort of overruling their, you know, their condescension, maybe you could say. You know, they've really brought themselves down, you know, deep, you know. But he could say, no, don't work down there at eye level. You need really big picture here. I mean, certainly in the case of rebellions and stuff in local systems, you know, that kind of big picture influence would be very much in play. You know, what's the big picture of the Ancients of Days, you know, in this circumstance? What advice should you give to the Most Highs about how to handle this?
Is Norlaisha Deck in quarantine?
Yeah, I mean, the way that, I mean, not, I mean, within, you know, Norlaisha Deck, you have various levels of isolation. You know, you have very, very deep isolation on the rebel worlds, you know, less deep on the system. You know, but then there's, you know, the local system is very limited in how much you can interact with other local systems. See, and that would be within more of the constellation context.
I think they refer to as being still in quarantine.
Right.
To some extent. So,
yeah. And it's just in that sense.
Now, yeah. These guys would be, could be a lot more helpful in working with the Most Highs,
mm-hmm.
Because we're still, you know, the whole constellation is still
happening. Yeah, again, you know, be careful about that. Yeah, I mean, you don't want to think of our constellation as being limited in its communication with other constellations. There's nothing like that. But you definitely have less of a holistic linkage system going on within the constellation. I mean, it's partially linked now. You know, they had to break some linkages within the constellation, but not
well, I didn't mean
outside.
That, but what I meant was the, you know, the administration or the dealing with the situation at the Most High level.
Right.
Which, you know, these guys probably have some.
And the way that manifests is the Most Highs send Verondadex down, you know, to engage this. And that, you know, so they're, like, you know, like I was saying, that the faithful of days is bringing the big picture down. And so, you know, for instance, look at it on our planet. We have this Most High Observer. And if he assumes regency, he acts with absolute authority, as if the Universal Father was standing right here. You can't appeal things or anything. See, so it's a very father-like thing. See, coming down from the Ancients of Days through the faithful days into the Most Highs down. Yeah, see, so it's this very direct conduit of this definitive father-like expression. Yeah. okay. Let's see, anything else there? No, I think that's it. So let's get a little bit into the general administration here now. go ahead.
Section 6, General Administration. Gabriel is the chief executive and actual administrator of Nevadon. Michael's absence from Salvington in no way interferes with the orderly conduct of Universe Affairs. During the absence of Michael, as recently on the mission of reunion of Orvontan Master Sons on Paradise, Gabriel is the regent of the universe. At such times, Gabriel always seeks the counsel of Emmanuel of Salvington regarding all major problems.
In there, you know, that's the definitive thing. I mean, because Gabriel's not God, basically, you need this personal representative of the Universal Father at his side. You know, if there's some really big things going on, you know, he needs that advice because it gets a little beyond his scope of recognition. So another reason to have Manuel not, you know, lowered himself down into this circumscribed domain. He's got a very big picture that he can, so he can really help Gabriel or the Father Melchizedek, you know, if the Father Melchizedek happens to be the one that's standing there beside Emmanuel and Gabriel's off doing other things. Yeah, just like the faithfulness of the faithfuls of days, there's, you know, a definitive faithfulness of integrity that's coming in by the union of days as well.
So I like this reunion of the Master's Sons on Paradise. That's kind of cool that they do that. You know, kind of like one of your 50s. He must only be pretty new at it because he's only been a Master's
Son. Right. Yeah. One would think this would have been his first trip to,
It's kind of cool.
It also reminds you of, how fast creators, Master's Sons especially, probably even more so, you know, how fast they can travel, you know, that they could get to Paradise and back. That's not a big deal for them to go to a reunion on Paradise and then come back again. and we're thinking, well, okay, so, you know, several hundred thousand years later, you know, you arrive back. But for them, it's just a quick trip. All right.
The Father Melchizedek is Gabriel's first assistant. When the bright morning star is absent from Salvington, his responsibilities are assumed by his original Melchizedek son.
By this original Melchizedek son, yeah. And, I've already said that many times. You know, just remember, it's not just the firstborn Melchizedek. The Father Melchizedek is a different type of being than the other Melchizedeks. Specifically, the other Melchizedeks are brought into existence with three parents, the Creator Son, the Creator Mother Spirit, and the Father Melchizedek participates in that. See, so that also reminds you of, okay, the Father Melchizedek's not a creator being, but is serving in a procreator mode with creators in that instance even. You know, besides being in a procreator mode with Gabriel and Sporanga, I mean, that's, so, in some ways, you wonder if maybe the Father Melchizedek maybe has some elements that are higher. Maybe he can get closer because of the relationship to the Creator Mother Spirit, perhaps. So he can really get intimate with that creative act. He's basically the analogous Eve son. He's the son that's like the Creative Mother Spirit. All right, as we've mentioned already, we know there's this one special time when both of them could be off Salvington and be here since Emmanuel took over.
The various sub-administrations of the universe have assigned to them certain special domains of responsibility. While in general a system government looks after the welfare of its planets, it is more particularly concerned with the physical status of living beings with biologic problems. In turn, the constellation rulers pay especial attention to the social and governmental conditions prevailing on the different planets and systems. A constellation government is chiefly exercised over unification and stabilization. Still higher up, the universe rulers are more occupied with the spiritual status of the realms.
Okay, so they give you a bunch of kind of specific details to reflect on there. But what's the overarching threefold pattern that's being expressed? We've mentioned it a number of times. You have three levels in a local universe: local system level, constellation level, and the headquarters, local universe headquarters level. And in that order, bottom up, they're individuality, associativity, unity. Unity, like they just said there, still higher up, the universe rulers are more occupied with the spiritual status, the unity aspects of the local universe. You know, when they talk about social conditions, you know, the associativity at the constellation level, you know, and then the individuality issues down at the system level. So that's, you know, in an overarching philosophic understanding, that's what you have. Individuality, associativity, unity, as you go up the hierarchy in the local universe. And then you do it again in the super universe. Minor sector, major sector, headquarters, individuality, associativity, unity. So then, you know, you take those at general idea of associativity, and you just can think about all kinds of different ways that something is associativity-like and would be handled there. Social and governmental conditions. The unification and stabilization of individuality. See, is happening as you're getting into the associativity, the association of that individuality as you go up. Okay, so just, you know, it helps to kind of just boil it down to the basics like that, so that you can, you know, because there's all kinds of details within those domains, and you can get lost in figuring out what's going on. But that's it's a very simple pattern, actually. It's just a threefold actuality: individuality, associativity, unity. That's just over and over and over again, that same pattern. All right.
Ambassadors are appointed by judicial decree and represent universes to other universes. Consuls are representatives of constellations to one another and to the universe headquarters. They are appointed by legislative decree and function only within the confines of the local universe. Observers are commissioned by executive decree of a system sovereign to represent that system to other systems and at the constellation capital. And they, too, function only within the confines of the local universe.
Okay, so this little side. So this is whole analog to what we have on Earth here. You know, and they, you know, use the analogous words. So at the biggest level, you have ambassadors. And below that, you have consuls. Notice they're weaving in there too. Another aspect of how you have things distributed through the three levels. The judicial is at the local universe capital level. Legislative is at the constellation level. Executive is at the local system level. And so in each case, if you're going to have an ambassador appointed, it's not by executive decree, it's not by legislative decree, it's by judicial decree, because the judicial level's at the top. You know, and you see the same thing, you know, legislative decree for the consuls and executive decree for the observers. So they just wove that in. You know, they'll talk about that more, but that whole distribution of the three branches of government is spread over the three levels. And like I was saying earlier, they tell you that it's not a coincidence that you have three branches of government. That they've been working on evolving that into existence, bringing that down definitively for the first time on this world in the United States, to finally get the three branches very directly expressed on this world. All right.
From Salvington, broadcasts are simultaneously directed to the Constellation Headquarters, the system headquarters, and to individual planets. All higher orders of celestial beings are able to utilize this service for communication with their fellows scattered throughout the universe. The universe broadcast is extended to all inhabited worlds, regardless of their spiritual status. Planetary intercommunication is denied only those worlds under spiritual quarantine. Constellation broadcasts are periodically sent out from the headquarters of the constellation by the chief of the constellation fathers.
Okay, so, you know, we were just referring to that a little bit ago. So you have this whole elaborate, communication network woven through the local universe. And it has a hierarchical structure, so it can be, it can be managed in many different ways. In one of those ways, they, of course, refer to there, where they say planetary intercommunication is denied only those worlds under spiritual quarantine. And remember, we talked about these communication grids back when we were dealing with those beings that handle the spirit energy, like the power beings handle the physical energy, those universe circuit supervisors, and the spirit controllers that are basically unrevealed but alluded to a couple times. And that they pointed out that the way these circuits are set up is you have both physical energy and spiritual energy laid out in parallel so that there's a super additive consequence of mind energy between them. So that you create a mind energy conduit that is actually that minds link into and communicate through that mind energy. And the way you shut one of those down is, see, it's under spiritual quarantine. It's literally, it's the spirit energy part that's taken off. So then there's no mind energy. There's just, you still have these physical. The physical grid is still there because they're using that for all kinds of other things too. But the spirit element is taken off. So that it's literally spiritual quarantine, the spiritual energy. It's not in some mystical way or something. I mean, it's just literally the spirit controllers that take away their lines of spirit energy so that the grid is shut down.
And it's a dial-up instead of
right. Yeah. Yeah. It's a very low baud modem now. You have the ability, like they're saying, you have a central node to these grids where you can be on Salvington and you can pump a message into the whole system for the whole local universe. Or you can be on a constellation headquarters and you can pump it into the whole constellation grid. And then the other thing to remember about these grids is it isn't just to get across space. It's not just about interplanetary communication. They'll speak of it as universe communication, one turning communication, the wholeness. Because through that grid, high beings can talk to low beings, even if they have no ability to do it, on their own, standing in, next to each other. So there's an upstepping and a downstepping mechanism built into this grid, so that all beings, high and low, can be in communication as they're, all higher orders of celestial beings are able to utilize this service for communication with their fellows scattered throughout the universe. So you have that. That's a very important element, and
we don't use it.
You're right. Yeah, mortals, in general, don't use it on a world.
Long list of things we don't use.
And an example of how this is an issue, like we were saying, archangels are very high spirit beings, too high to talk directly face to face with a with a secondary midware. So high spirit beings, their circuit, you know, that archangel circuit that's on this world, the secondary midwares, you know, can't plug into that circuit. You know, they can jump up trying to get to it. It's too high. Okay, they talk into the microphone, if you want to, you know, however literally you want to think about it. It's literally a circuit that's like the archangels, and the secondary midwares can't relate to it. It's not just that the archangels are kind of prickly, and people, you know, like to kind of just leave them off to the side and let's work over here. I mean, the secondary midwares cannot utilize that circuit. So that whole bit of, you know, in order to get the book to us, those papers that were coming from high beings, they couldn't use that as a downstepping mechanism to get from a divine counselor, say, to a secondary midware, because the secondary midware can't get it. And eventually the secondary midware has to have the paper because he's the one that's got to write it. Okay? And so they couldn't use that archangel circuit. They had to do the contact personality mechanism for those handful of beings that are too high to talk directly to the secondary midwares. And that's when it's really handy if you're a mighty messenger, say, right? And you were one time immortal, and even though you've gone to paradise and, you know, all that rigmarole trillions of years ago or whatever, you still can relate all the way down to mortal level. You can relate to a secondary midware still directly. So a mighty messenger doesn't need that complicated thing. He can just dictate the paper to the secondary midware. But the divine counselor, no. You know, they have a hard time, you know, even being knowing that there's material stuff here. I mean, you know, secondary midwares are going to be very ethereal to them. You know, they're not going to be able to engage them.
Communicate with the secondary midware?
Yes.
But also a Melchizedek can communicate with an archangel.
Yeah, yeah, the Melchizedek.
They could have used a Melchizedek.
Yeah, see, that sort of thing. See, they didn't use a personal intermediary. Isn't that interesting? See, you can think about that. They, I don't want to go off on that tangent, but that's in play to think about that. You know, why that mechanism? But, you know, for the solitary messengers, for, you know, the solitary messenger that, you know, did the adjuster papers, for the archangel, ones, the handful of papers that are done by archangels, the divine counselors, the universal censors, and the perfectors of wisdom, you know, they can't engage. And it may be, too, the primary Supernaphim, that's chief of Seraphim. It's a little uncertain, but maybe that primary Supernaphim had to use that mechanism too. but in, you know, that's one of the reasons why so many are written by Melchizedek. That's just so much easier. Okay, you don't have to use that whole complicated thing. The Melchizedek can just dictate the paper to the secondary midwife. So, you know, it's no wonder so many are. Yeah. So. And then obviously, you know, for part four, you don't need anything. I mean, the secondary readers are just writing it. So, yeah. All right. Let's see. What else do we have here? I think that's it there. Okay, so let's go to the next little tidbit they toss in here.
Chronology, is that where we're at?
Mm-hmm. Chronology.
Chronology is reckoned, computed, and rectified by a special group of beings on Salvington. The standard day of Nebadon is equal to 18 days and 6 hours of Urantia time, plus 2.5 minutes. The Nebadon year consists of a segment of the time of universe swing in relation to the Uversa circuit and is equal to 100 days of standard universe time, about 5 years of Urantia time.
Okay, so, you know, when they talk about these days, you know, this is, you know, they're telling you how long it takes Salvington to rotate on its axis, okay? You know, so it's literally a day, okay? So, you know, you get an idea of the kind of angular momentum that's going on here with this world. And you notice this is going to be a very complicated thing. If you're going to sync everyone up in the local universe, okay, I mean, it takes time to communicate, you know, the standard clock, here. You know, so they had all this reckoned, computed, and rectified. I mean, if they're going to be broadcasting this into the network, they've got to take into account all of the time lags and all these issues and whatnot. So it's a very complicated system to broadcast the clock throughout the system and get to have everyone synchronized to the same chronology. So you've got very sophisticated, you know, technicians involved with that. And then, you know, I think most people appreciate this now. I mean, they have some day that is, you know, like in this case, is, you know, it's dictated by how long it takes this world to rotate on its axis. And then years are built in the decimal system. So years are always 100 of those days, whatever the day is. You know, if it's a gerasim day, you know, a local system, year is 100 of those days. So you have that basic thing of just multiply the day by 100 to get a year. And you notice what they did here. You know, for us, you know, a year is going around a central body. You know, the Earth going around the sun. And they're saying, well, you don't literally have that there. You know, those 100 days, Salvington doesn't go one time around some central thing. But the local universe of Nebadon and the other local universes in our minor sector, is going around the Milky Way galaxy, going around Universa. It's the center of the Milky Way galaxy. So there's, you know, there's a little bit of that sort of thing. There is, you know, but of course, over just those 100 Salvington days, this is going to go a tiny little bit of that arc of going all the way around. It takes a very long time to go all the way around. But see, they're referring to that. They're just saying that you can kind of think of a little bit of an analogy there of that movement around. But it's just a very small fraction, obviously. Because, I mean, 5 years of Urantia time, okay, it's going to... I mean, you're going to have to be very sophisticated to even measure that tiny, that small an angle, you know, of going around. That's just a tiny
it's
little.
How long it takes for an angel get to.
There's that. That's an interesting little thing that there seem to be indications it's about a 5-year trip from here to Gerasim, you know, at 3 times the speed of light. And again, they give that precision of how long the day is. On the one hand, to just remind you that this is all very precise. I mean, obviously, this reckoning and computing and rectifying is going to be, you know, to many, many decimal places. It's not just going to be to, you know, 2.5 minutes sorts of coarseness. But they're reminding it's all very precise. And it is giving you, you know, relatively precise conversion number for working with. That probably comes into play as you go forward with the revelation over the centuries. It's probably important to have some of these numbers quite precisely, as we'll discover at some point. You know, it's giving you an idea. You've got a pretty big world, you know. Salvington is going to be big, big world. You know, and it orbits, you know, rotates once on its axis in just 18 of our days. Okay, so it's moving, you know. It's just giving you an idea that these things, you know, have a relatively rapid rotation. You know,
the size of Nebadon is equal to relative to our...
Size Salvington, you mean?
Yeah.
Now, see, you don't know these sizes. They tell you with the constellation, you know, that it's like the local system where you have Earth size for subsatellites, 10 times for satellites, and 100 times for the central world. But beyond that, they don't give you direct things. I won't go into it now, but you can start to make some estimates, you know. You know, if it's going to be roughly Earth gravity, you know, you know the rotation period here. So you can, you can calculate some sizes, estimate some sizes, making some assumptions. That's another thing that's going on between the lines with those sorts of numbers. Okay. Let's see. All right, let's get some more here. Yeah.
Nebadon time, broadcast from Salvington, is the standard for all constellations and systems in the local universe. Each constellation conducts its affairs by Nebadon time, but the systems maintain their own chronology, as do the individual planets.
So, yeah, just that little tidbit, because I want you to notice a little something there. So again, we were talking about unions of days and faithfuls of days and how you have this very tight linkage, and then there's the local systems. So you see it even here. So the integrous portion is very tightly linked, even in terms of chronology. Okay, but the local systems have a distinct separateness. And if they go off in rebellion, they're on their own time scale.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they can break from the ticking of the clock of the local universe in very definitive ways. That's all part of the system. Is there anything else there? Just to mention, if things are running smoothly, they do very much keep themselves, in sync with the rest of the local universe. It's the standard for systems. Okay. So if you want to be non-standard, you can, though. But the constellations have no option to be non-standard. They're just part of the whole rigid, standardized part of the local universe.
The day in Satania, as reckoned on Jerusalem, is a little less, 1 hour, 4 minutes, 15 seconds, than 3 days of Urantia time. These times are generally known as Salvington or Universe time, and Satania or System time. Standard time is Universe time.
Yeah, that last sentence is important because every once in a while in the book they say standard time, and you got to remember this sentence or what that refers to. The thing here you notice, because a year is always 100 days, it happens, then that a local system year is not that different than a Urantia year. It's kind of the same ballpark. Our 365 days. That makes it kind of easy if they talk about 2 years time on Gerasim. That's roughly 2 years of our time. But you got to remember the conversions if they're talking about Uversa time or Salvington time. It's, quite a bit different. But for Gerasim, it's roughly close. So, you have 2 years of the rebellion resolving on Gerasim. And that's roughly 2 years of our time as well. And then you notice that there was 7 years before Van and crew, knew quite what was going on here. So 2 years, and then once it's resolved after 2 years, and if it's a 5-year trip, 7 years, see? It's very suspicious that it's a 5-year journey, roughly. Because there was 7 years, and it tells you it was 2 on Gerasim. It's like, 7 minus 2, I think, is 5. It's looking suspicious. And then they tell you again, it was 5 years in advance of the Melchizedek's arriving that they could see that Eve was starting to drift in directions. Sure enough, 5 years later, the Melchizedek's arrived. So, it looks like it's a 5-year journey. So it's roughly about 15 light years to Gerasim. All right, well, that's... It's a great place to stop when we're right on time and everything. Think about very definitively, that, they tell you the gravity on Gerasim is roughly Earth gravity. Now, you've got these issues. You don't know how much anti-gravity influence and whatnot, but, you can dabble with this. You can at least, try some estimates of, well, if it takes that long for Gerasim to rotate on its axis, what kind of you know, a centrifugal, you know, force do you have with that kind of, you know, that rotation? If something that's 100 times the size of, you know, the Earth. And see, you can play around with it a little bit. See, you can do a little bit of physics, you know, a little calculation with these things. You know, and here they give you, you know, down to 15 seconds. So, all right. So we'll probably, you know, wrap up this paper next time and get into the Creative Mother Spirit, finally get to that primary rupture that we keep referring to. We'll get, you know, you see as you glance, they're going to talk a little bit more, like I said, about the judicial, legislative, executive, that they just kind of slipped between the lines there in that paragraph. Now, that's the kind of one remaining thing that they want to flesh out a little bit more. All right, so let's... you got a question, Bruce?
Yeah.
Yep.
A little ways back, did you say that, like, Emmanuel would have handled, like, the rebellion a little different than Michael did?
Yeah, I mean, because Emmanuel reminded Michael that, you know, he's following the orders of the Ancients of Days. Mm-hmm. And the Ancients of Days run a tight ship.
Okay. So. Now, when Michael's gone, and then Gabriel fills that role.
He would be following Michael's lead.
Because it says Gabriel always seeks the counsel of Emmanuel of Salvation, right, regarding all major problems.
Right. He would if there was a big problem. Okay. See, there's always the potential there of, you know, things being handled a little more definitively, mm-hmm, if Michael is gone.
Absolutely.
Right. You know, it's now, of course, you know, as a master son, Michael, you know, would have some very definitive way that he wants things to be handled, and you know, the Emmanuel in a sense is, he doesn't have the place that he did before now that Michael's a master son. Michael has, you know, complete, you know, sovereign authority now.
Okay
so so Emmanuel, you know, would always be he wouldn't be counseling in any way contrary to that.
Okay.
You know, those sovereign dictates of Michael. You know, exactly how that all plays together. See, I mean, you know, who knows? Okay. But certainly, you know, if Michael has said, okay, while I'm gone, you know, if you need to do something a little more definitively,
yeah,
Emmanuel can definitely help you with the details of that. Okay. You know, if that's what Michael is given authority to, you know, to do. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. See, it says Michael's absence from Salvation in no way interferes with orderly conduct of universal affairs.
Yeah.
So, like, even when Michael's gone, and say even Gabriel and Melchizedek were gone, like, that happened here on your ranch, correct?
Yeah, see, that was just a very special thing. I mean, okay, that won't happen again.
That's, like,
right,
very rare.
Right. It was only because of the seventh bestowal that both of them had to be off Salvington. Otherwise, one is always on Salvington. You know, and again, because it's only that one time that Emmanuel actually assumed authority of the local, you know, control of the local universe. He normally doesn't do that, you know, no matter how long Michael's gone.
And that's still when it doesn't change, like, the order.
Right. So that's anyway. Right. So that's the, all you can do is kind of just speculate about, yeah, you know, what that order is.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. But you at least know that if Michael has authorized some sort of definitive action and he's not present, all the counsel that Gabriel or Father Melchizedek would need is in place with Emmanuel. Yeah. All right, let's take a moment here.